Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that can't avoid reality any more than anyone else who lives in this part of the Inland Northwest. Yeah, we're coughing too. Reality is on the docket this week for a variety of reasons, one being that the three of us decided last week that we'd check out three new documentary films that just started streaming. One, Feels Good Man, tells the story of artist Matt Fury and what has happened to his creation, Pepe the Frog. Another, Class Action Park, gives us a feel for how a no-rules-allowed New Jersey theme park gave a generation of thrill-seekers a bundle of fun, bruises, broken bones, and for some, something even worse. Finally, the mole agent follows a man in his 80s who goes undercover to investigate life in a Chilean nursing home. Let's begin this week's show by checking out the evolution of a cartoon frog. If you've never heard of Pepe the Frog, that might be a good thing. It might mean you're a normie, which, depending on your point of view, also may be a good thing, normie being an obvious abbreviation for normal. Pepe, which some adolescent-minded people in Arthur Jones's documentary Feels Good Man pronounce as pee-pee, is a creation of artist Matt Fury. And speaking of adolescent, Fury originated Pepe as the protagonist of his 2005 comic titled Boys Club. Over time, though, Pepe, in various guises, has become the subject of a series of memes, many of which, most controversially, have been co-opted as a symbol of white supremacy. Jones, using a blend of live-action interviews and animated sequences featuring the various gestations of Pepe, documents just how that happened, and it's a story that is both illuminating and scary. Well, at least it is for us normies.
Yeah, this is almost like a horror film, and what's fascinating about it is that it seems to unfold both in slow motion and as if it's sped up simultaneously, because the speed with which Pepe the Frog goes from being this kind of cult comic character to kind of a harmless internet meme to an alt-right surrogate character to just a straight-up symbol of white supremacy is remarkably quick. Like, it seems to happen overnight, and yet what's so good about this documentary is that it kind of shows the evolution over the years. It wasn't something that happened overnight. It happened quite gradually. But I think what makes this movie work is that not only do you have all of these professors who are experts in meme evolution, which is a thing in the 21st century now, explaining how these things work, but you also have Matt Fury there. And Matt Fury is kind of like the poster child for that idea that once an artist releases their work out into the world, it doesn't belong to them anymore. It belongs to the people that consume it. I mean, this is kind of like the worst case scenario for that sort of thing happening, because he's trying to get this character back. He's trying to reclaim Pepe the Frog as the harmless, lovable stoner that he is. And, you know, he has no control over this boulder that has started rolling down the hill, and he's trying to catch it, but it is, to continue that metaphor, a Sisyphean task in a lot of ways.
Nathan, why don't you just explain what the title means, Feels Good Man?
Oh, okay, sure. Well, Feels Good Man is basically Pepe the Frog's catchphrase, and it originated in a comic that was the comic that became a meme on the internet, where one of his roommates catches him urinating with his pants all the way down on the ground. And he says, "Why are you doing that?" He says, "Well, feels good, man." And it sort of, you know, encapsulates that Pepe the Frog is, you know, he doesn't really care. He's laissez-faire. He's just living his best life. And so to see a character who is kind of this lovable loser in a lot of ways be co-opted by the hateful fringe on the internet is
not so lovable losers.
Yes, exactly. I mean, to see that happening, it's kind of heartbreaking, because you feel for Matt Fury in so many ways. So this is a really fascinating documentary. I mean, I think it speaks to our time. It speaks to sort of the paranoia that I think a lot of people feel on both sides of the political aisle. And this story gets crazy too, because by the end, Alex Jones has been brought into this, and there are insane deposition tapes with Alex Jones talking about Pay the Frog. Yes, exactly. The conspiracy theorist. So it's kind of crazy that we can have this serious discussion about this cute cartoon frog. It just seems so silly, but so in keeping with sort of the absurdity of the time that we live in. So I thought this was really fascinating. I knew about Pepe the Frog. I knew that he had been put on the Anti-Defamation League's list of hate symbols, but I didn't really know the story behind it or why it became co-opted the way it did. And this filled in a lot of gaps for me.
I thought the probably one of the more intriguing aspects of Pepe the Frog's story was the fact that it's, you know, the creator was so naive in many ways, which made him oblivious to the fact that something such as this could happen. So early on, some of the people surrounding him, recognizing Matt Fury's talent, basically urged him to take some steps, maybe to protect his character a little bit more. But, you know, he's this laid back Bay Area guy. And he was like, no, you know, I want this to be sort of a product for everyone and so forth. And he had no idea how it could be co-opted. And I mean, I think that's at least part of the story. There's also this whole side story about him and his wife and his baby daughter, his toddler daughter, who shows up periodically. And she sort of reflects the innocence of the creator. He discovers himself in this big, bad world. And eventually he does have to get lawyers involved, you know, to try to push back and reclaim, because his own efforts to reclaim Pepe as a peace symbol were not entirely successful, despite his, you know, efforts. Or at least we think that, until we see these protesters in Hong Kong who have adopted a variation of Pepe as their symbol for peace, freedom, and justice, and so forth. So the arc of this documentary was fascinating to me because it touched on so many different aspects of society, not only in the US, but worldwide. And it gave us some insight into hate groups and sort of how that mentality takes over in ways that I guess I'd never really fully appreciated.
Yeah. And both of you have touched on the one of the more interesting aspects of Feels Good Man is the fact that anything that's created now, particularly in this first two decades of the 21st century, but also in the latter part of the 20th century, is you put something out there and very quickly it isn't yours anymore. Somebody's sampling your piece of music. Somebody is sampling, you know, a cartoon meme, whatever, and they're turning it into whatever they want it, for good or bad. And that in itself is frightening. But one of the things that I find really most interesting is in this film is the animated sequences itself help propel this whole narrative. So we've got the live action, we've got archival news, we've got interviews with people, including Matt Fury himself. But some of the most interesting stuff is how Pepe the Frog, or Pepe, however you want to pronounce it, becomes a part of the storytelling process. And I think it's done really, really very well.
They also, at certain points in the film, sort of analyze, you know, the why of it. Like, why Pepe the Frog? There are millions of memes out there. Why was this the one that caught on?
Right.
And sort of the answer that we get is that, well, one, it's a super easy character to duplicate because it doesn't require a lot of artistic talent to draw Pepe the Frog.
Although sort of like, Matt Fury is a pretty talented guy. You're absolutely right.
He is. You see other art that he's done, and that's, you know, that kind of
much more sophisticated. Yeah.
Yeah. The sort of childlike drawing is not his, you know, predominant style. So there's that. But there's also this idea that Pepe the Frog kind of allows for the shield of irony in front of actual hate, so that these internet trolls can say these horrible things under the guise of this wet-eyed cartoon frog, and they can say these horrible things, but say like, no, but I'm really just kidding, but I'm really not. So there's you know, there's actual, you know, kind of like a psychological element to this about why, you know, this particular fringe of the internet attach themselves to this character in such a way.
Which makes a larger statement about the whole controversy over comedy right now, in which are jokes real? Are they not? Is everything really a joke? Is there irony underneath everything? Does satire work, even work anymore? There's a whole lot of interesting stuff that this movie Feels Good Man unpacks and opens up for a larger discussion.
The other thing is, it was ironic because when finally Matt Fury decides, oh, maybe this, maybe Pepe has some commercial value, and they decide to make some t-shirts and make some mugs and so forth, maybe without trademarking them, that was never really clear. Then that's when Pepe is hijacked. And so that was sort of ironic.
That's
that,
right.
So they, just the timing was.
They end up with a whole garage full of t-shirts that they can't sell.
Yeah, t-shirts with unintentional hate symbols all over them.
Yes, exactly. And so that was Feels Good Man. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Class Action Park and The Mole Agent. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
In 1980, Spokane Public Radio's very first fund drive was taken down when Mount St. Helens blew. Fast forward 35 years to 2015, and our first fund drive from historic fire station number 3 was blown down by a giant windstorm. SPR operated by bouncing the signal off of the old building, where we had enough power from a gas generator to power one light bulb and one radio station for a few days. Through natural disasters, wars, civil emergencies, recessions, civil unrest, and now a pandemic, Spokane Public Radio has been here to help our audience make sense of it all. On air and online, our service is here for you because of you sustaining or becoming a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for helping provide a great public radio service.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbender, and I discussed the documentary Feels Good Man. Let's now move to a couple of other reality-based documentaries, Class Action Park and The Mole Agent. Let's begin by heading to New Jersey. If you lived in or around New Jersey between the years 1978 and 1996, you likely heard of Action Park. You may even have gone there. Standing in line with the thousands of other visitors who weren't afraid to buy their way into a theme park that boasted few, if any, rules. In their study both of the park and of its founder and controversial owner, Eugene Mulvihill, documentary filmmakers Seth Porges and Chris Charles Scott III start out the way many park visitors did, as if they're going on a lark. Gradually, though, while interviewing both visitors and former park employees, they affect a more serious tone, which is consistent with the various injuries caused by what was essentially Mulvihill's capitalist Darwinian attitude. Not just bruised backsides and broken bones, but over the years, a number of deaths. Action Park may have been fun for many, but for those unfortunate few, it certainly earned its nickname, Class Action Park.
Or Traction Park. So I'm going to take the lead here on discussing this because I actually lived about 15 minutes away from, well, maybe 20 minutes or so away from Action Park back in the 70s and 80s. And it was certainly an infamous locale. But I think the one thing that the film doesn't talk about, it makes it sound as though it's easily accessible for people from New York and other places. And it's really not. It is out in the sticks of northwestern New Jersey. And
which people don't think of as rural. They think of it as a completely urban atmosphere in New Jersey. But trust me, it's more rural than Richville.
And so it's fascinating that the documentary focuses on the park because one of the main problems dealing with the park, at least in its early years, was the fact that alcohol flowed freely there. And then people, there was no public transportation available. And, you know, there was no Uber, there was no Lyft. So then people were getting back in their cars and driving over an hour back into the city or back to Newark and so forth. And so they didn't even talk about the drunk driving car accidents that were associated with Action Park. But it's one of those sort of slices of life or badges of honor, as many of the people who are interviewed attest to, that you survived Action Park, sometimes not with all of your body parts intact. And that was obviously one of the problems. But it's presented as this sort of frontier land where anything went. And that was, I think, basically true. Also, they were trying to develop this whole area as more of a resort, destination resort area for skiing purposes.
Year round, yeah.
Yeah, there was a Playboy Club there for some period of time. And Mulvihill, you know, did have a good idea. He just refused to play by any of the rules. I mean, for example, when it was discovered, and we see this alluded to in the film, when it was discovered that one of the Alpine slide had a tendency to rip off bathing suits, especially those of young women, then he set up a viewing platform so that you could watch these bathing suits being ripped off of your fellow park goers and so forth. And I think from a lawyer's perspective, I go back and forth between thinking this was really a horror show. But at the same time, have we gone way too far in the other direction in terms of making everything so safe and pristine and sanitized? And that's probably a good word to use during a pandemic, that Class Action Park feels as though maybe some risk taking, maybe a little bit safer, would be in order. Because a couple of years before this documentary was released, there was actually a pretty lengthy article, I won't say an expose per se, in Sports Illustrated about Action Park. And it interviewed some people, some even famous people who had been there, although they didn't reveal too much, such as Cory Booker. But it also focused on Johnny Knoxville of Jackass fame and his experiences there, because he made an earlier movie that focused on what happened. And he said it was some of the stunts that he tried to replicate from the 70s and 80s were some of the most dangerous ones that he had ever done. So Class Action Park does highlight the sort of best and worst of, I guess, an earlier
humanity.
Time. Right, of all aspects of humanity. And Knoxville called the founder, Mulvihill, a genius, but he was a mad genius. I think that that would be fair to say. From my perspective, the fact that he was able to sort of bamboozle the political powers that be in this small town area to help him avoid some liability for what transpired is another aspect of the story, along with all of the youthful workers. I mean, it employed, you know, almost every kid who lived in this forsaken area.
Some as young as 14
time,
years old. Yeah.
One time or another. But I think it just doesn't quite wrap up effectively, because we see all this stuff. It's interesting. It has these interviews in Class Action Park about what happened, about people's individual experiences. We get into a portion of, you know, talking with the family whose child was actually killed there. But then it doesn't really know how to end things. And I don't know what would have been a better ending, but I think this film just lacks one. This documentary film just lacks an ending.
The one thing I'll say is, I mean, I think you've covered it all as the New Jersey expert here, but I do think there is, and this is probably an unfortunate word, but there's some tonal whiplash going on, I think, in the closing moments of this film, where it careens into devastation, essentially, where they're, you know, they're talking about the fact that, yeah, this was all fun and games, but people really did die, and you know, we're kind of plunged into this. And then it kind of ends with this sort of like, but wasn't it a great place anyway? And so I felt kind of weird about that. But I think as sort of a history lesson, not just of the park, but of New Jersey at this particular point, it's really interesting and occasionally quite shocking watch.
And that was Class Action Park. Let's close with The Mole Agent. We've all seen documentaries, honest if perceived depictions of real life, and we've seen mockumentaries, phony and mostly satirically comic depictions of the documentary form itself. Chilean filmmaker Maite Alberti Soto straddles the two with her film The Mole Agent, which New York Times critic Glenn Kenny accurately describes as a documentary drama hybrid. It begins as a type of spy film and ends as a meditation on aging, with 83-year-old Sergio Chami ostensibly being hired by a private investigator played by Romulo Atkin to check out what's happening at a Santiago, Chile nursing home. The residents, mostly women, were told that they were the subject of a documentary, and so they act naturally as Shami plays out his role. But what at first seems like a gimmick ends up being something both sad and profound, as Alberti Soto's camera captures the sometimes spirited, awfully lonely existences of people, most of whom have been abandoned by their families as they near their life's end.
Yeah, there were moments in The Mole Agent where I did wonder if what I was seeing was staged for the camera. For instance, Sergio is sent into the nursing home with eyeglasses that have a hidden camera in them and a ballpoint pen that has a hidden camera in them. But he never really needs to use them because the filmmaker's cameras are right there at all times, to a point where I wondered, how phony is this? How real is this? But I do think there are truths in this movie, particularly as you mentioned, Dan, in regards to the abandonment that these people feel, because what begins as an examination of neglect from the staff of the nursing home becomes an examination of neglect on behalf of the families of these people that have been left at the nursing home. That the real threat facing these people isn't the staff, it's the fact that nobody is checking in on them from their own families. And so that's to see that they've kind of created their own sort of makeshift family within this Chilean nursing home. It's both very sad and very sweet at the same time.
And I think especially during this time when people have not had access to their relatives who might be in assisted living or in other sorts of nursing home type facilities, I mean, I think this film will be especially poignant. And there are a couple of things that are revealed during this film that were shocking to me. For example, if you were not married, it appeared as though your family might drop you off at this nursing home at age 50 or something, which seems a little premature. But so I think The Mole Agent is definitely one of those films that's worth watching. Having a little bit of backstory about what's happening here, I think is helpful. And Nathan, you and Dan and I talked about that a little bit, because maybe just a more of a framing about what was going on or maybe how the project morphed could have been useful or helpful at some point.
And that was The Mole Agent. And this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed Feels Good Man and Class Action Park. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that streaming cinema has to offer. Until then, remember these words from the late, great science fiction writer Isaac Asimov. Your assumptions are your windows on the world. Scrub them off every once in a while, or the light won't come in. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.